This is Donald Sandiner, and this was the 4th of October, 1996. The Future of Jungian Analysis in the 21st Century, tape 2 of 2.
I have a few more people are aware of this. Shamanism is just one more. That's all it concerns itself with, really. I mean, the rest of it is, there are a lot of, you know, it has a lot of playthings and stuff. But at the center of it is that attainment of to work in ecstatic, in an ecstatic state. Now, I think ecstatic state is not it's not an unusual thing. Many people have it. It's just that it's been so discarded and downplayed that people don't think it's worth anything. So that when you have it, you think, oh well, it was just because I've been to the movies or I heard a good piece of music or. And now I have it, but it'll go away. You know, it's inflation, and it'll go away, and suppress it. They don't lead into it. Where it's not really. I mean, you may be inflated when you get into it, but the work, the spiritual work, is always an inflation, and then the reason's task is to deflate it, not to be inflated in it, but just to have it. I mean, not to start to use it in a lot of, you say, to gain power, you know, to gain power, but to use it to live with.
So does it change
the quality of your life? Yes. Yeah, it begins to. If you get past the stage where you can, you recognize it and you can understand it as something separate from anything else, like from art. You know, like if you go to a concert, I remember going to a concert once by Pavarotti. It was an evening concert in Oakland. It was absolutely wonderful. He was at his best. That was about 10 years ago. And it was the ecstatic was there all the time. But you might say, oh, it was just because it was Pavarotti, you know. But sometime that kind of feeling might come when you're by yourself. And sometimes it comes after a great shock, something that shocks your system or that changes you, something, some outer thing impinges upon your life and that will awaken it. It's what people call awakening. There's an awakening in that. Yes?
It's a little late to get here, and I know, but it's coincidental or synchronous.
Synchronistic.
I heard an interview on KBOW with Bill Myers, and their interviewer. He was talking about the mysterious genesis, it's part of EPS 16, and it's right along these lines. He was talking about the fundamentalist religion being used in a powerful way, you know, how but the group that they really focused on for this was just
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they were looking at the Old Testament characters.
Well, and I think that if you had the union of that ecstatic thing, like I think being reborn in Christ is an ecstatic state, but you have to have it with a certain amount of consciousness. See, if you had that. You had the feeling, and yet you had the consciousness that it isn't, that would not fundamentalize it, but make it available to everybody.
Well, that looks like the theme of this series.
Yeah.
Can I ask you one more?
Sure. Yeah. Out of your ego, he meant. Outside of the ego. That there's a reality here that the ego didn't make. It's just there. He's a figure like that. And Jung said later that that was his real teacher. Yeah. Because Freud wasn't so wise. Okay. Yeah, I think that's probably something we have to really wrestle with, because I'm unwilling to give up the spiritual path as part of the Jungian journey. So if we're going to have, you know, I think we have to have it in, as I call it, in tiers. That's why I put it in tiers. That in that first tier, you might have a very reductive analysis, you know, a developmental analysis. And it might very much be that way. That may be what you need. Because I think that stuff from the past can stand in the way of the further development. So you may need just that, and for a long time. Because I think these things, roughly, they correspond. I think that kind of thing is best. You know, and the Freudians always said it. It's best when you're about 30, because then you're old enough to take responsibility. You're old enough to know you can't just do it by yourself. But I think then as you go on through life, these other paths become more, these other tiers become more central. Like when you're in the middle of your life, you're concerned with the relationship, your marriage, your children, and everybody else. And then the spiritual life moves in. But that still is, to me, it's not really analytic at that point. But it's the development of the spiritual path. Then you have to, and that's where I think you have, so I think at that point you take responsibility for it. In the others, the therapist must take a lot of the responsibility of keeping the temenos. But at this stage, you have to be able to have a critical appraisal of your own and go on by yourself. But it seems that it's the same path to me. It's the same path. It's not a different path. Yes, well, that. Well, I mean, we're all mixed up now. You know, some people do only the spiritual path, some people do only the psychoanalytic path and all these other paths. But I think if you just put forward, there is a hole here that we can wrestle with in the next century. That there is a kind of overall picture that you could kind of refer to in reference to all these. And I don't think anybody could do it all, you know, or could really handle all that required throughout as your analyst or teacher. Or you need more than one. You need two or maybe three. But if it's your path and it's that's why you live, you know, that's the value of your life, then that's no, it's worth it. Okay. Anyone else? Or type of transfers, yeah.
Can you say more about the third stage of the type of transfers? You see that as a more like world transfer?
No, archetypal. The first stage would require parental transference. In the second stage, it's more relationship-centered. There's still a transference there, and it's still kind of parental, maybe hovering between parental and archetypal. But it's very personal. Like Kohut. I think Kohut may be the person who knows the most about that. Real empathy, how real empathy can enter into it. But I think it works at only a certain point. It can be undone if you have too much shadow complexes in there. And that could be, that's closed off, or it closes off. But if not, then you're in the relationship with the analyst. The deep empathetic relationship. And that's why I say we're in that kind of transference. In the first tier, you're often more outside it. You're a parent, and you're there. But it's not so much you. It's sort of a transference that you accept and allow to be there for the patient. In that second tier, it's more you. It's partly parent, but it's also a lot you there in that emotionally. I don't mean you tell the patient personal life, but emotionally, you have a stronger presence for the patient. So you hold them emotionally while they gather it in. They kind of gather it around the center. And then in the last, it's more archetypal. a third, if you want, a third tier, like Netanyahu, so he was more archetypal. We did not have a strong emotional relationship. In fact, you know, Navajos do not put out strong emotional tones. They just, their face is blank. But there was a strong archetypal transference. It was almost purely that. Yes.
Could I ask you some questions to spread it off a little bit? There was some way that I noticed that there's something that said way early in that almost seems to hint at this too, and it was you said about that archetypal, the difference in archetypal when it's about this whole web, this whole functioning thing where they're responding to each other, they're sending signals from, they're presenting problems and gifts and so forth, as opposed to when
yeah, yeah, right, yeah.
What if the second tier is sort of like one, the unlearned or something that you kind of like grab on one argument, you kind of like makes it very big on that one thing and squeeze a lot of things.
Yeah, it's sort of like that. And so somebody asked me if it was entirely gender based. You know, I speak about it because that's the way Jung spoke about it, as gender based. But, excuse me, I don't think it is. I mean, I think the anima for a man can be a woman or a man. And the animus for a woman can be a woman or a man. It's function-based, not gender-based. Although, because, I suppose, in Jung himself was a very masculine person, so his persona was very masculine, so that his anima was pretty feminine. But he tells us that his anima, the only time he names her, he says it's Salome. Salome. No, that's what kind of anima is that? Is that? But that's the only time when he really named. I think she was other things as well, but she could be. Well, like that dream I told you, she almost was the humpback of Notre Dame, except she had Marlene Dietrich's face, you know, in a way. It isn't gender based. It's that function it plays, the soul function that kind of pulls you into the soul and the reality of that soul, rather than spending your life running around looking for it. I mean, you spend your youth running around looking for it, and then you find out it's not out there. So you spend the rest of your life looking inside. It is there. It's still there, too, in a different way, yeah. But you have to look in first and say, ah, there it is. You know, there's all those stories about going to foreign lands and you have to make the journey to foreign lands and it isn't there. And then you come home and there it is, beneath the hearth. And that's really, that's what those stories are all about. You know, that you've got to go around and see all those places where it isn't. And then you see where it is. I think it's well past 9:30. We're supposed to.
Today I'm going to try to humanize the shadow. I brought a couple of icons from my Sanplay collection. That nice little garbage can, Janet, came from Judy's dollhouse at the south end of Santa Rosa. And the devil is a traditional Russian figure, I'm told. Bijou archetypes in Walnut Creek carries them, but I got it in a shop in Capitola. I'm told that in Russian households, most homes have one of these. And if something disappears, if you lose your car keys or something, then what you do is you take the devil and hang him by the tail in the corner, and you tell him he's not going to come out until it turns up. And then he doesn't like being immobilized, so then it turns up. So it's, but you can see he's full of, he's very dynamic and full of energy. And, I'll get to that later because that's an important part about the Satan figure, is the energy in it. Well, I wanted to put in a plug for Kinko's Coffees, that if anybody ever calls you up and wants to do publicity on one day's notice and ask for a picture, what you do is you go to Kinko's Coffees and they do your passport. Very quick. Well, those two represent the poles I'm going to try to work between today, the mundane and the archetypal. The garbage can reminds me that in Porterville, California, which is a town up on Highway 49 in the gold country there, the garbage used to be collected by a private scavenger company, and on the side of their truck they had a slogan, "Satisfaction guaranteed or double your trash back." And I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on Satan, I think. But I thought I'd begin with my freeway piece, since probably everybody is driven to get here. This is something that's been anthologized in Meeting the Shadows, with, unfortunately, a few typos added. The original title of this was Merging a Parable, and I wrote it with psychological perspectives in mind, but that was a time when they were sort of going cosmic and they didn't want anything this trivial. So I thought about it for a while, and then I thought, well, maybe it's journalism. So I sent it to the San Francisco Chronicle, and it wound up on the back page of the Sunday magazine section called An End Paper. And they changed the title to Devils and Angels Play the Merging Game, and they added a wonderful picture. They also shortened it and made it a little less psychological. So it sounds like it's about driving, but it's really about shadow. This appeared in 1987, I think. Two mornings a week, so I invite you to identify with this, I'm sure you can. Two mornings a week I have a rush hour commute, in the course of which, as traffic approaches a tunnel, four lanes converge to two. The change is announced by a sequence of signs. Two left lanes close 1/2 mile. Two left lanes close 1/4 mile. And two left lanes closed, merge right. The final merger is enforced by barriers eliminating the left two lanes and by the reality of the impending two-lane tunnel. Oops. When I began making this trip, I would use one of the two right lanes since these survived into the tunnel. The extreme right lane was made unattractive by the merging of outside traffic into it, and usually I would find myself in the second lane from the right. If I were in either of the two left lanes, as soon as I saw the first warning sign, I would move right to be in a surviving lane, again the second from the right. At that time, even if I had thought about it, I would not have seen anything remarkable in my prompt compliance with the warning signs. I did not experience a choice. I simply took it for granted that one obeys the signs. With later reflection, I see my compliance in psychological context. I was a younger sibling, the son of a school teacher, a good child who caused no trouble, oriented toward doing right and achieving. I grew up to be a responsible, law-abiding citizen. Breaking the rules would not be my way. The trouble was, on the freeway, while I sat in the second lane waiting patiently or impatiently to get into the tunnel, I would notice that a few less conscientious citizens stayed in the left lanes as long as possible until they were physically forced to merge right, at which point they would crowd into my lane ahead of me. Even worse, sometimes I would see in my rearview mirror that some psychopathic scofflaw approaching the bottleneck would pull out of my lane into the clearing left lane, speed past me to gain some advantage, and pull back in. I was surprised at what this situation brought out in me. Initially, I was merely annoyed at the spectacle of other people, unhampered by proper superegos, profiting from doing wrong while I did right. But I grew increasingly resentful about it. My younger sibling's sensitivity to unfairness was aroused. They were getting away with something forbidden to me. I was angry not only at the interlopers, but also at the highway patrol motorcyclists, who I felt should be in there preventing this sort of thing, rather than on the shoulder, ticketing speeders they had targeted back on the freeway. I found myself feeling surprisingly competitive. Often the aggressors were driving Porsches or BMWs, or they were cowboys in little pickup trucks, which when unloaded are very nimble. While my sedan is roomy and gets more than 30 miles to the gallon, a rocket ship it isn't. Inferior and envious, I entertained fantasies of big engines and turbos. Unable to compete directly, I expressed my anger passively by trying to keep the bad guys from horning in ahead. I became proficient at the art of bumper-to-bumper driving that left no room for the intruder to enter. I knew this was at the expense of my clutch, but the satisfaction of frustrating the ambitious was worth it. I had not yet questioned my assumptions about the morality of the situation. Those people in the left lanes passing me and barging in ahead clearly were bad guys. I was in the morally correct position, and if the world were just, other people would behave as I did. The trouble was, it wasn't, and they didn't. Or rather, most people did. I was in the law-abiding majority, but that fact didn't take care of my feelings about the rest. My indignation was righteous, and if my counter-aggression got a bit nasty, they deserved worse than that. I could have spared myself the whole problem by starting 10 minutes earlier, before the bottleneck had formed, but usually I'd left home at the last possible moment and was guiltily worried that I might be late to my first appointment. I wanted to get through the tunnel, and I saw no reason why others should get through it ahead of me by cheating. Perhaps I thought of cheating too, but I felt a certain gratifying moral superiority, a self-satisfied pride in persisting in virtue against temptation. In the immediate situation, though, virtue was expensive. I was losing. I was a virtuous victim. What finally happened came out of a simultaneous combination of unusual tardiness, accumulated anger and envy, moral collapse, and curiosity about life in the fast lane. One morning, I deliberately got into the far left lane and stayed there as long as I could. Then I merged right into the next and stayed there as long as I could. Finally, I entered my usual lane and passed into the tunnel. I can't say that it felt just great or anything equally simple. I had gone over to the enemy, but the enemy was still the enemy. I was uncomfortably aware that I was violating my own principles for immediate gain, that I had sold out. My sympathies really were with the well-behaved people into whose lane I was now squeezing, some of whom were viewing me with the same righteous hostility in which I myself had only recently been indulging. On the other hand, the guilt wasn't really that bad, and I did get through the tunnel faster. Since then, interesting things have happened. I have deliberately experimented with all four lanes, trying them out psychologically and seeing how they feel, how the world looks from each of them. When I am not being consciously experimental, I approach the bottleneck from the far left lane because it works better, it's faster. When I do this, I am a member of a relatively small minority. Most drivers don't even wait for the signs to tell them to move right, but have already put themselves in the tunnel lane some distance back. Knowing the route, perhaps they don't get into the left lanes at all, so that they won't have to get out of them approaching the tunnel. That's what I used to do. From my new vantage point, this seems like remarkable self-restraint. How is it that there are so many unnecessarily good citizens when it is clearly advantageous not to be good? Actually, it is the virtuous behavior of the moral majority that clears the left lanes for the rest of us to be sociopathic in. If all four lanes were equally used, there would be no point in maneuvering. Those who merge right early create the opportunity and temptation for the rest of us to go as far as possible before complying. We are two sides of a coin, those angels and us devils, complementary and interdependent, that we need them to be good to provide our opportunity. They need us to be bad, to disapprove of, feel superior to, and punished by exclusion. When I play the devil and look over to the right at the people I'm passing by, I do become aware of a sense of loss, of something sacrificed in breaking out into the freedom of naked self-interest. No doubt that's why it took me so long to lose my virtue. With some nostalgia, I remember the comfortable feeling of community, rectitude, and self-esteem that I enjoyed when I was still a sheep and not yet a coyote. And how scornful I felt then toward the depraved anarchist rolling by on my left. But when I try to recover my moral purity back in the sheep lanes, I'm reminded of the bumper sticker, "Nostalgia ain't what it used to be." The satisfactions of virtue don't quite make up for the price of being passed up. But the most interesting development is that for me, the situation finally has got de-moralized, unloaded of virtue and vice. Now my perception is that this is just a place where four lanes narrow to two, and there's nothing right or wrong, good or bad, about the resulting merger. My former experience of it as an ethical issue was my own projection. I define myself as the virtuous victim and those others as bad guys, aggressive, selfish, lacking in community feeling, successful, and enviable. When people now glare at me as I invite myself into their lane, I can appreciate their anger from the memory of my own experience. I don't feel angry back when they try to shut me out. I feel rather calm and matter-of-fact about it all. But they seem a bit strange, turning a simple take-turns merger into a morality play. And amusing. I try not to smile visibly as they prove their virtue, manhood, and patriotism by making me drop back behind them, because some of them might be packing guns. This was 1987, let's see. Apparently I can no longer project that war movie onto this particular screen. I'll have to find a new arena in which to distinguish the good guys from the bad. I feel like none of the above. I need a new bumper sticker, "Merge Easy." I'm going to pass this around so you can see the picture the Chronicle artist did. I lost money on this, I think, because I think they paid me $100 and I bought the picture from him for $75. And cost me $40 to get it framed. Anybody recognize that? I found that most people have developed a position, a strategy, a policy about this that they adhere to and are consistent with, and they also regard it as the right way. As we generalize our own typology, we generalize our own morality. Most people think they've got the right answer and they're righteously offended toward those others. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Right, you can do a lot of work in a relationship. Well, I was surprised a couple of weeks ago to get a call from somebody at the Harvard Law School. He said he was with something called the Harvard Negotiation Project, and they were about to have a conference. I don't know. Negotiation Project sounds like it's about conflict resolution. Maybe combat resolution, too. And they had a conference coming up and wanted my permission to duplicate this to the tune of 250 copies to distribute to their conference. So apparently they don't think it's just about driving. So I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Anybody want to say anything about that?
Resolve that is just reading. I read the Mortimer Bell, and
You hear a good deal about that in ecology circles in terms of the tragedy of the commons, or the certain amount of common grazing land, say, and then if everybody pursues total self-interest, then they use more than their share and the whole thing gets destroyed and nobody has anything. I think with this situation, probably the pursuit of individual self-interest is not at the expense of the community, because I think the whole string of cars gets through at the same rate no matter what anybody does. I mean, that's limited by the size of the bottleneck. That's why I came to see it as a projection screen, really, in which all the morality does not have an objective basis, but is imposed by my projection. Oh, accidents, yeah. A friend in Vancouver told me that up there they do this at 50 miles an hour, and they call it zippering. They just merge at 50 miles, and because they're civilized and polite about it, and they're not competitive, so they're not trying to keep anybody else from doing what they need to do. I thought that was heartwarming. Well, I don't want to get stuck on driving, but what about shadow projection and reclamation and merging in that sense? Anybody have any reactions to that? What do you suppose the Harvard Law School is up to? Well, for me, it did puncture eventually the morality play, and I would recommend as trying them all out, seeing what it feels like, seeing what you feel like with those different strategies. It's worth exploring. It's a way of exploring the shadow in a minor, mundane way.
Out of that, the situation ends up being much more efficient.
Sure, you can always do that, but you're assuming that the people that do that are there's some net cost to the whole.
Well, you can't
zip. Right, it would disrupt zippering, and it might generate collisions. On the other hand, the people in the right lane create collisions too. I presented this in a group once, and a woman was reminiscing about days a few years back. She'd outgrown that, but at the time she said her practice was to get in the left-hand lane and then drive at the speed limit. And 55. And I said, well, I'm surprised you're here to tell us about it. But there's such a thing as passive aggression as well as active aggression. But we keep falling back into driving. Maybe this makes the most full use of available space. It's possible. Okay, let's forge ahead. Read you another short piece. This is Eric Neumann, Depth Psychology and a New Ethic. By the way, I hope I didn't spook anybody with that reading list that I contributed to the publicity. I did label it optional, and that's what I meant. But I thought if people wanted to read about shadow, those were some of my favorites. And this has always been one of my favorite Jungian books, and some years ago I was disturbed to find that it had gone out of print. Neumann is better known for The Great Mother or Origins and History of Consciousness, some of his essays, but so I thought that was a serious lack. And about the same time, my friend Lou Stewart discovered that Neumann's The Child, which was one of his favorite books, had also gone out of print. So Lou and I began to agitate in San Francisco, and somebody did something in New York, and somebody did something in Zurich, and eventually Shambhala came out with new editions of both books, and as reward, Lou and I were invited to write forewords for the new editions. So that's why this says, this is the new edition, Depth Psychology and New Ethic, Eric Neumann, forewords by C.G. Jung, Gerhard Adler, and James Yandel. Right up there. It shows what can happen if you make trouble. So this was a few years ago, 1990 publication, and this is about as good an introduction to the shadow in general as I think I could do, even today. So I'll lay it on you. It's not too many pages. We are all born with much the same human nature. That nature includes in potential form capacities for such virtues as loving generosity, compassion, altruism, courage, patience, and wisdom. It also includes potentials for other qualities like callous selfishness, greed, envy, cowardice, cruelty, pettiness, destructive violence, and willful unconsciousness. Before we have been long in the world, we begin to learn that some aspects of our nature and expression win approval from the powerful giants on whom we are dependent, but that other elements are not so acceptable. Needing the love of others and our own self-esteem, we cultivate in ourselves whatever is rewarded as good and try to exclude from our behavior and sense of self that which is disapproved and punished as bad. Positive, negative reinforcement. The contents of this distinction vary, but the process of socializing and shaping a child by the reinforcement of approval and disapproval, reward and punishment, is universal. The environment's response to us during our early years in the family is the foundation of our sense of good and bad in ourselves. It is followed in later years by the inculcation of our society's values by school, church, mass media, and other social institutions. The psyche tends to formulate experience in terms of paired opposites. In our culture, socialization intensifies this predisposition. That is, the splitting thing is, I think, stronger in our culture than others. We are taught to distinguish, separate, and split, especially to split good versus bad. We are taught to aspire to goodness, even perfection, to identify with the positive side of our nature while denying and disowning the negative. Put it in a garbage can. The resulting split state is considered normal. Our identification with the good gives us a permanent bad conscience and sense of fraudulence, for at some level we know we are not what we aspire to and pretend to be. Most of us know, although I mentioned last night, Jung would marvel that there really were people that believe they were what they pretended to be. What becomes of the rejected portion of our humanness? How do we deal with what C.G. Jung called the part of us that we don't want to be part of us? That was one of his definitions of the shadow. In general, we try to repress it from consciousness and exclude it from our self-definition as we identify with the light. But it is no less real for being banished from ego territory. Quite the contrary, removed from conscious awareness and control, it gains autonomous power. It is full of energy and has ways of finding expression, often in forms clearly visible to others, if not to us. That others know all about our shadow. Bring it to our attention generously. This disowned portion of our nature is part of what C.G. Jung called the name the shadow. The optical metaphor of shadow recognizes that shadow is produced by light and is the shadow of the light. So shadow is the consequence and inverse of consciousness. The shadow includes primitive and undeveloped portions that have never been conscious, as well as that which has been experienced and rejected by the ego. I am not that. At times, Jung equated the shadow with the whole unconscious. It has individual and personal levels. What I edit out of my self-concept and official identity will differ somewhat from what you exclude from yours. There is a cultural level. One nation's notions of good and evil are different from another's. And there are collective universal levels of shadow, such as our uniquely human aggression and destructiveness, which threaten to destroy the planet by nuclear war, pollution, and reckless consumption. Simple repression is not sufficient to sustain one's sense of virtue and superiority. It is necessary that the excluded shadow contents go somewhere, have outer form, be personified. For Dr. Jekyll to be stable as Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde is required. Projection, then, is added to repression, and the rejected elements of the personality find a repository out there. Whatever is denied and disowned at home is discovered in another person or group, and they are seen as inferior and subhuman, the villain and enemy. This is a much more satisfactory arrangement, more satisfactory than inner conflict. One can now feel comfortably free of taint as one despises, condemns, and attacks one's projected evil in others. This can occur in the individual or at the group level. or one state may denounce another as the evil empire or the great Satan. Individual or collective self-esteem is supported by prosecuting the struggle against the enemy, often with the expressed aim of destroying him and eradicating evil forever in a final triumph of light over darkness. Hitler's projection of evil onto the Jews logically led to his program of purifying Germany by exterminating them. In wanting to make Germany Judenrein, pure of Jews, Hitler was one of the world's great idealists, which should leave us with a permanent lesson about purity and idealism. A further step in this process is mutual shadow projection, in which each of a pair of persons, groups, or states serves as the perceived enemy of the other. These arrangements can be remarkably stable and long-lasting. The adversarial dance between polarized opponents may be contained and ritualized, as in the duel of some marriages, formal debate, which is a war game, professional football. I'm missing the 49ers this afternoon. In the duel of some marriages, formal debate, two-party politics, bipolar sports, and other zero-sum games in which one side wins to the extent that the other loses. Or it may be uncontrolled and immensely dangerous, as in race conflict or in Cold War, between adversary pairs of states whose stability rests precariously on the deterrent threat of mutual assured destruction. MAD. In an age of nuclear armaments trigger-ready for overkill, mutual shadow projection becomes an unaffordable and potentially catastrophic indulgence. With the apparent end of the Cold War, there has been some recognition in American thought of the problem of our loss of a clear and pure enemy. Saddam Hussein filled in for a while. The economic success of the Japanese may fill this need with the resurgence of the yellow peril to replace the red menace. Critical judgment is not necessarily shadow projection. That is, every time you perceive something you'd call evil out there, you're not just dumping your own stuff. I don't mean that. But when the finger is pointed, it is useful to look not only at where it points, but also back at the finger pointer to see what motivation and benefit might reside there. That is, what is the finger pointer getting out of it? Self-elevation by denouncing others is so tempting and gratifying and so universal that no condemnation of apparent evil should be taken entirely at face value. Psychologically, the only effective alternative to shadow projection, with its attendant hazards and costs, is its opposite: shadow recognition, acknowledgement, and integration. This is the subject of Eric Neumann's precious volume, made again available in this new edition. What Neumann calls the old ethic, the Western religious and psychological tradition that sets spiritual perfection as its standard and goal, requires that we own only the good part of our nature and sustain this inflated self-idealization by projecting the negative onto others. The insights of depth psychology, he believes, offer us permission and means to move beyond this practice to a new ethic in which, freed from the futile ambition and requirement of perfection, we can own and deal with all of our nature. In this orientation, the highest value is no longer perfection, but wholeness and reality. By the way, the Christian, be ye therefore perfect, even as your heavenly Father is perfect, I understand is a mistranslation, that the Greek word, I think it's teleos, properly translated would be complete or whole, or perhaps perfected, which means completed, but not perfect in the sense of without blemish or taint. In this orientation, the highest value is no longer perfection, but wholeness and reality. That is the orientation of depth psychology. Such an ethic requires that we recognize and deal directly with our unwelcome humanness, rather than project it onto an enemy who, as carrier of our rejected shadow, becomes a psychological necessity for us even while we seek to destroy him. Neumann's proposal is revolutionary. As every psychotherapist knows, the withdrawal of projections is the most central and difficult part of the work. Finding and hating one's own evil in others is familiar and habitual, and paradoxically comfortable even when one is in a paranoid rage. Giving up the benefits of such projection is arduous, slow, and uncertain. One's self-esteem is at least temporarily damaged as one's scrutiny turns from the mote in the other's eye to the beam in one's own. Perhaps even more difficult than acknowledging our wickedness, which at least has a certain glamour, is recognizing our ordinariness. The banality of our foundation as mortal animals can be painfully deflating. I call this the OHS factor for ordinary human slob. I think that's the hardest thing. The hardest thing for us to own. But there is gold in the muck, and as shadow integration proceeds, one reclaims substance, energy, and creative imagination that have been consigned to the sewer or to the devil. One has the strength that comes from being in accord with reality rather than in desperate defense of a false self-idealization, and one recognizes the high cost and true poverty of the previous identification with the good. The ultimate net effect of the shift from the old ethic to the new is relief, revitalization, and a new competence to deal with real rather than invented problems. One moves toward wholeness. If this is difficult for motivated and psychologically minded persons in the safety of the analytic container, what can we hope for at the collective level? Neumann's vision may be wishful fantasy. Yet daily we analysts see in our practices that such changes do occur in individuals as part of their therapeutic work and individuation. In collective life, shared experience and awareness of danger, like the threat of atmospheric destruction or nuclear annihilation, can produce new consciousness of a common enemy, transcending the prior adversarial structure. Ecology, with its recognition of the wholeness of the earth and its vulnerable interdependence of parts and processes, is almost entirely a development of the past few decades, a product of our being forced to recognize the self-destructiveness of our abuse of the environment. A political ecology is also developing. National boundaries are increasingly artificial, and one world has progressed from wished-for ideal to commonly experienced fact. Neumann, in effect, proposes a psychological ecology in which all parts of the psychic system are to be recognized, owned, and integrated into a whole functioning. This may also be possible. It surely is necessary. Last page. Jung said in 1959, in response to interviewer John Freeman's question about the likelihood of world war, "We are so full of apprehensions, fears, that one doesn't know exactly to what it points. One thing is sure, a great change of our psychological attitude is imminent." That is certain. Part of such a great change may be the vision elaborated by Neumann in this volume. This is a quote from Neumann. "The time has now come for the principle of perfection to be sacrificed on the altar of wholeness. The time has now come for the principle of perfection to be sacrificed on the altar of wholeness." Depth psychology in a new ethic has had a difficult history. Around the time of its publication in 1949, there was considerable opposition among Jung's Zurich followers to Neumann and to the book. Neumann was in Tel Aviv by then. And it was rejected for inclusion in the official list of Jungian publications. Neumann was Jewish. This may have had to do with the thorny problem of the relation between individual inner moral authority and outer collective authority as raised in Neumann's new ethic. I think I won't try to go into that, but that's an important part of the book. or it may have represented a reaction to Neumann's assertive style, jealousy among Jung's disciples toward the intruder from Tel Aviv, whom Jung regarded so highly, or Jungian anti-Semitism. Despite Jung's endorsement and foreword, that is, in the original German edition, the book did not appear in English for another 20 years. While Neumann's other works have become Jungian classics, this book has been relatively neglected and in recent years has been out of print in English. In its richness, succinctness, and urgent relevance to our times, it may ultimately prove to be his most valuable work, and its renewed availability is cause for rejoicing. In the 1959 interview, Jung went on to say, "We need more understanding of human nature, because the only real danger that exists is man himself. We know nothing of man, far too little. His psyche should be studied, because we are the origin of all coming evil." In this volume, Neumann has made a major contribution to that study. So I recommend the book to you. This edition, the current edition, is 1990 Shambhala. Oh, well, it was published in 1949 in German, and I guess 69 would then be the first American edition.
Can I get the title?
Depth Psychology and a New Ethic. Neumann, N-E-U-M-A-N-N, first name Eric, E-R-I-C-H. Yeah, he'd been in Zurich and then he went to Israel and died of cancer in his 50s, I think, in Tel Aviv. So I think he was kind of the shining star of Jungian writers, and I think there probably was a good deal of jealousy and rivalry toward him, plus whatever degree of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism was the norm in Europe and was operative in the Zurich Jungian community also. Any reactions to that? Requires a distinction between conscious experience and action, and the two don't have to go together. We often make that confusion about anger, don't we? When we say people should be aware of their anger, then we immediately assume they're going to go kill somebody. But action does not have to follow consciousness, and often consciousness of emotion or anything else can be a preventive against impulsive, explosive acting out. I think it begins with tolerance for what's in you and your portion of human nature, which Harry Stack Sullivan said we're all more essentially human than otherwise, and we share a lot more than our differences, although we're also each of us unique. But a part of what we are is stuff we don't like, the part of us that we don't like to be part of us. And we're certainly the most creative, intelligent species ever to appear on the planet. We're also the most destructive and in certain ways unconscious. So, I think I'd just be repeated. Does that respond to what you were asking?
I work a lot with adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff feedback and all that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I don't have that experience and can't offer any advice, and you have my sympathy, but... But isn't it kind of a general rule of thumb that you help try to help people become aware of their feelings and verbalize them if possible, rather than remain unconscious of them and clobber somebody? Well, we're partly having somatic problems. One level of shadow is the natural person, the uncivilized, natural, basic, fundamental, instinctual person. Now, obviously, that's just what it is. We think we should get rid of it or rise above it or civilize it or perfect it or whitewash it or something, but that's just a fact. And so, and when you start reclaiming shadow, then that's part of what you get access to, and there can be a lot of strength and energy and good stuff in that. I think I'll have to be careful not to take it too far the other way and begin to idealize and romanticize shadow, because we just are incredibly destructive and violent and stupid, and we may well wind up obliterating ourselves. I mean, we're certainly on the way to doing that on the planet. And unless there's some major change in that, and Jung thought that man was not ever going to change his basic nature, then that's the course we're on, is one of total destruction, I think. But shadow, almost by definition, shadow is an ego attitude. If there's something that you're scared of and hostile toward and are trying to expel from your definition of yourself, repress, it's likely to appear in a dream in a monstrous form. And the more hostile you are toward it, the more monstrous it's going to be. And the faster you try to run from it, the more threatening its pursuit will be. But if you can stand and look at it, then it begins to shrink down and you can transform it. There used to be this research from some Malaysian tribe, the Senoi, where community life included importance attached to shadow, and there would be morning meetings in which people would share their dreams, and the children were trained in dreaming, and they were, one of the things they were taught was that if you encounter an enemy, an adversary, a monster in a dream, then you don't run, you stand and face it and you relate to it somehow, and ideally you make friends with it and extract some boon from it to bring back, as in the hero cycle. So that was kind of systematic cultural training in how to deal with the part of us that we don't want to be part of us. But I'm going to get into that a bit more, because I'm going to read you a little bit of Robert Bly, who says exactly what you were saying. Yes?
That's why I went to
in adult life, when I was able to go back and look at that area, there was a lot of that. When I could see my kids' interest in that, so they want to get rid of some fruit temporarily that might be one very bad for this adaptation.
Well, probably the genetic foundation of our aggressiveness is the hunter, the early hunter. I mean, it was survival. So, was what?
Pride system.
Pride system.
By breaking down pride systems, you get access to the shadow.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Another concept of the little self hate.
Well, the notion of the contralateral, contrasexual component is part of Jung's theory, his system. The anima in the man and the animus in the woman are, the anima has a feminine quality and the animus has a masculine quality. To the extent that those are repressed and disparaged and condemned, I guess you could call them shadow. In a very narrow sense, then, shadow is a figure of the same sex that, say, comes up in a dream. But Jung would get impatient with that kind of nitpicking, and he'd say the shadows of the whole unconscious is the shadow. So it can kind of be whatever you want, but to me it means the shadow of consciousness. It means something rejected by the ego or experienced by ego as negative and threatening and hostile and despicable. And that changes, of course, as you begin to relate to any... If Henry Jekyll could have related to Edward Hyde, then the story would have come out very differently. I think that can be useful. I wouldn't assume it. I'd consider it, though. Jeremiah Abrams, who was, along with Connie Swag, edited that anthology of Meeting the Shadow, which has my Freeway piece in it. By the way, I talked about the Porsches and BMWs pulling out around me, and in that book it got turned into putt. That was a very unfortunate type. I went to a book store reading of Abrams, and he was saying that to his audience that, well, if you look around the room, there are some people you like and some people you're indifferent to, and then maybe there are some people you just can't stand. Now, those people may have some importance for you. Because that is a very strong emotional connection of a negative sort, and it can be an indicator that there's something of you in there that you could pay attention to, at least worth considering. how come you can't stand them? What is it about them that bugs you so and drives you crazy? When you start exposing other people's. Yeah, they don't appreciate your generous advice. Right. Yeah. In the psychological world, what therapists and psychology students do to each other is, I can see your unconscious, but you can't see mine. That kind of one-upmanship can be quite provocative. I don't know if this is quite what you're getting at. I think the formation of personal shadow is inevitable developmentally and necessary for the, we tend to, some of us idealize children as little angels, but they're also little devils and little savages and do need some training and civilizing. And so for ego to develop, I think it's necessary that some elements of the personality get repressed, suppressed, brought under control, denied, some persona form, because persona is the archetype of adaptation to the outer world and getting what you need and want. But then the time comes, and I'll get into that shortly, where there's the I mean, if that didn't happen, then we would be undifferentiated and undeveloped. So we have to sweep some stuff under the rug or put it in the can. But then there's the possibility later on, maybe, of retrieving it. And not only the possibility, but maybe the necessity as it becomes symptomatic or it causes us trouble in our lives. Does that have anything to do with what you're talking about?
I mean, the word sin carries so much stigma and connotation, but I guess when I reflect on the notion of sin, I think in that sense too, that it's not a failing or failure or non-attention due to ignorance, but it's when something is presenting itself to consciousness, we have sort of an awareness of this thing, there, then you turn away from it. The sense thing of respect of shadow. When things move into shadow, you might say, or shadow is composited or is given energy initially. I think, you know, most of that is at a time when there's not really so much good choice. You know, we call it instinct or whatever. It's kind of a moving of necessities. But it's later in life, as Larry was suggesting, when there is that kernel of consciousness that's now being acquired, when you make a decision, you make a choice, that there's a sin, if you will, or there's a change of a kind of a principle that arises. In respect for ourselves, not necessarily respecting other persons, but that's a kind of a denial of self.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about that? Unconscious separation as opposed to
Willful unconsciousness, I think, is a certain kind of sin or evil in itself. And I mean, the more developed we get, the more possibility we have, I think, of consciousness and choice. And so then that's sort of where ethics operates. And if you could know something and choose not to, that's pretty bad. I mean, in a way, that's worse than just being ignorant and naturally unconscious. Well, let me lay a little Robert Bly on you. This is one of the books I put in the list, a little book on the human shadow. And does Bly come to town? Have people seen Bly up here? He's quite Jungian, and we used to employ him to do public performances for the Jung Institute until he got too successful and famous and expensive. So we don't have him much anymore. I think I heard him do the original version of this at one of our conferences, and I went down to him afterwards and said, "Robert, that's the best thing on the personal shadow I've ever heard," and he was very pleased. So this is called "The Long Bag We Drag Behind Us." I didn't bring the bag, but I brought the garbage can. And I'll just give you a couple pages of it. Let's talk about the personal shadow first. When we were 1 or 2 years old, we had what we might visualize as a 360-degree personality, full circle. Energy radiated out from all parts of our body and all parts of our psyche. A child running is a living globe of energy. We had a ball of energy, all right, but one day we noticed that our parents didn't like certain parts of that ball. This is a little repetitious from what I read, but it's great minds move in parallel paths. They said things like, "Can't you be still?" or "It isn't nice to try and kill your brother." Behind us, we have an invisible bag, and the part of us our parents don't like, we, to keep our parents' love, put in the bag. I think it's to keep, we need their love and approval, and we also need the self-esteem that we get from internalizing their approval. So how we feel toward ourselves is also dependent on what happens with this adaptation. By the time we go to school, our bag is quite large. Then our teachers have their say. Good children don't get angry over such little things. So we take our anger and put it in the bag. By the time my brother and I were 12 in Madison, Minnesota, we were known as the Nice Bly Boys. Our bags were already a mile long. Then we do a lot of bag stuffing in high school. This time it's no longer the evil grown-ups that pressure us, but people our own age. So the student's paranoia about grown-ups can be misplaced. I lied all through high school automatically to try to be more like the basketball players. Any part of myself that was a little slow went into the bag. My sons are going through the process now. I watched my daughters, who were older, experience it. I noticed with dismay how much they put into the bag, but there was nothing their mother or I could do about it. Often my daughters seem to make their decision on the issue of fashion and collective ideas of beauty, and they suffered as much damage from other girls as they did from men. So I maintain that out of a round globe of energy, the 20-year-old ends up with a slice. The rest is in the bag. And we'll imagine that he meets a woman. Let's say they are both 24. She has a thin, elegant slice left. They join each other in a ceremony, and this union of two slices is called marriage. Even together, the two do not make up one person. Marriage, when the bag is large, entails loneliness during the honeymoon for that very reason. Of course, we all lie about it. "How was your honeymoon?" "Wonderful. How's yours?" Different cultures fill the bag with different contents. In Christian culture, sexuality usually goes into the bag. With it goes much spontaneity. Marie-Louise von France warns us, on the other hand, not to sentimentalize primitive cultures by assuming that they have no bag at all. She She says, in effect, that they have a different but sometimes even larger bag. They may put individuality into the bag, or inventiveness. That is, in some of these, quotes, primitive cultures that we romanticize and idealize, conformity is it. You know, there's no, individuality is not a value. What anthropologists know as participation mystique, or a mysterious communal mind, sounds lovely, but it can mean that tribal members all know exactly the same thing and no one knows anything else. It's possible that bags for all human beings are about the same size. We spend our life until we're 20 deciding what parts of ourselves to put into the bag, and we spend the rest of our lives trying to get them out again. Sometimes retrieving them feels impossible, as if the bags were sealed. Suppose the bag remains sealed. What happens then? The great 19th century story has an idea about that. One night, Robert Louis Stevenson woke up and told his wife a bit of a dream he just had. She urged him to write it down. He did, and it became Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The nice side of the personality becomes, in our idealistic culture, nicer and nicer. The Western man may be a liberal doctor, for example, like Henry Jekyll, always thinking about the good of others. Morally and ethically, he is wonderful. But the substance in the bag takes on a personality of its own. It can't be ignored. The story says that the substance locked in the bag appears one day somewhere else in the city. Mr. Hyde begins his depredations. The substance in the bag feels angry, and when you see it, it is shaped like an ape and moves like an ape. Edward Hyde was all hairy and brutish. The story says then that when we put a part of ourselves in the bag, it regresses. It devolves toward barbarism. Suppose a young man seals a bag at 20 and then waits 15 or 20 years before he opens it again. What will he find? Sadly, the sexuality, the wildness, the impulsiveness, the anger, the freedom he put in have all regressed. They are not only primitive in mood, they are hostile to the person who opens the bag. When we push something out of consciousness, it resents it, it wants back in, and it may well punish us for its exclusion. The man who opens his bag at 45 or the woman who opens her bag rightly feels fear. She glances up and sees the shadow of an ape passing along the alley wall. Anyone seeing that would be frightened. I think we could say that most males in our culture put their feminine side or interior woman into the bag. When they begin, perhaps around 35 or 40, trying to get in touch with their feminine side again, she may be by then truly hostile to them. The same man may experience in the meantime much hostility from women in the outer world. The rule seems to be the outside has to be like the inside. That's the way it is on this globe. If a woman wanting to be approved for her femininity has put her masculine side or her internal male into the bag, she may find that 20 years later he will be hostile to her. Moreover, he may be unfeeling and brutal in his criticism. She's in a spot. Finding a hostile man to live with would give her someone to blame and take away the pressure, but this wouldn't help the problem of the closed bag. In the meantime, she is liable to sense a double rejection from the male inside and the male outside. There's a lot of grief in this whole thing. Every part of our personality that we do not love will become hostile to us. We could add that it may move to a distant place and begin a revolt against us as well. And then he goes on to talk about Shakespeare's historical plays where somebody out in the boonies pulls a rebellion against the king, somebody who's been banished, comes back to try to overthrow the government. Well, I think that's about as much I want to do, but I also recommend Bly's little book to you. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll send them in two directions. I want to get to the archetypal realm. And spend a good deal of time on Satan. What point should we have a break?
Whenever you as a group feel that it's worth
it. Well, then, serious implications for relationships. We just sort of touched on that, and the two people in the car this morning with their different strategies. Anytime you talk about typology, you're likely to find that opposites are attracted to each other, and so often you're dealing with your typological opposite. And the inferior function is part of what is in the shadow. It's what we know least about in type terms. But would you like to bring in what you thought we hadn't brought in?
Well, I find that, relationship is what appears as a shadow. I'm curious about how it operates in relationships. The question that's talking to me a lot in the last several months, I've been doing a lot of my shadow work again, is when shadow gets projected back and forth relationships.
I think it's a real service to a relationship to be open to the possibility that you are making some contribution to the troubles. A lot of what relationships are about is blaming, and my motive for putting a lot of the blaming is defensive, because my motive for putting you in the wrong is so that I won't be in the wrong. And that's my way of getting one up, or at least not being one down. And the wish not to be one down is the main motive for trying to get one up, I think, in various situations. But clearly, if there's a fight, then if one party is willing to step back and say, now let's see what was my part in this and how did I contribute, and the other is not, and if that's part of the relationship in a consistent way, then clearly it takes two to de-escalate. If only one is doing it, then I think ultimately that one becomes the scapegoat. That's not a service to a relationship to volunteer to be the scapegoat. So I don't imagine we can formulate any rules of thumb about how long you do that or what you'll tolerate, but clearly it takes two to tango in various ways, both to fight and to de-escalate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You mean the very structure of it may be villain victim kind of a. I have a an opus called The Adversary Game, which I may or may not get to. It's a perverse little thing and written in the form of an instructional manual for how to polarize and escalate and work toward the end of the world. And I wrote it that way because there's so many books that tell you how to be reasonable and cooperative and all that good stuff, and nobody has written the other kind of book. So I don't know whether I'll get to that, but it does apply to mutual shadow projection in pairs, you know, which can be the U.S. and the USSR, or it can be man and woman, and everything in between. Yeah. Oh no, I don't get things into print much. Maybe we'll get to it. I'm going to do one little thing here just because it's in front of me and I kind of like it. And it's got a funny thing about Jung in it. This is entitled, Nice People Are a Public Menace. And I forget what the context was, but it says, as we have seen in previous pages, identifying with goodness and niceness has certain predictable consequences. Choosing to be perfectly and only good requires repression, exclusion from the conscious personality of that part of one's total nature that does not fit with the ideal. The denied qualities and potentials fall into the shadow. There they do not cease to exist but continue to work in the unconscious. They gain energy and autonomy by operating outside conscious awareness and control. A person in this virtue-identified condition is dangerous to others. First, because he or she is a shadow projection looking for a place to happen. The price of his or her sustaining an idealized self-image is for him to, for him to locate the rejected shadow components elsewhere in order to be sure that they are not in him. He needs a scapegoat, someone to carry for him his unwelcome burden of human nature, someone in whom to place his disowned elements, there to distance, denounce, and punish them. So this is really about blaming. Projection of the shadow is not a one-time event that takes care of the problem, but an ongoing dynamic activity. Psychic contents that have been pushed out of ego territory do not accept exclusion. They push to come back in. The frontier is never secure. Fear of incursion by terrorists and guerrillas requires constant vigilance and investment of energy. The return of the repressed is subconsciously felt to be an ongoing danger and threat. Because the recipient of the projection represents the expelled psychic contents that threaten to return from exile, that person or group is seen as an active enemy, hostile, aggressive, powerful, and dangerous. The Department of Defense stays busy. Even where projection is not so explicit, there is a subtle and diffuse toxicity that emanates from aspiring saints. It may take the form of an ongoing need to judge, disparage, and blame in order to reinforce the moral superiority of the virtuous one, or it may be that others in his proximity feel unaccountably unworthy, wrong, or sick. Jung offers a humorous account of such a situation, and this is from one of his trips to America. I think he would probably say only Americans would be like Jung wrote, I once made the acquaintance of a very venerable personage. In fact, one might easily call him a saint. I stalked round him for 3 whole days, but never a mortal failing did I find in him. my feeling of inferiority grew ominous. And I was beginning to think seriously of how I might better myself. This is what people like this do to you, right? Then on the fourth day, his wife came to consult me. Well, nothing of the sort has ever happened to me since, but this I did learn, that any man who becomes one with his persona can cheerfully let all disturbances manifest themselves through his wife without her noticing it, though she pays for her self-sacrifice with a bad neurosis. Well, I think I won't do the rest of it. I just wanted to get in that Jung story. Yeah. Oh, legal system is a war game, yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have this kind of infinite faith in punishment and exclusion as the answer to everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought you were talking about the court system, which is with ritualized combat. Mm-hmm. But you can legislate virtue and bring it about that way. Yeah. I want to throw in another quote from Jung, which I find very interesting. This is the subject of collective guilt. I mean, if you pick up the daily newspaper and read about all those atrocities and disasters and horrors, then it's probably not healthy to feel, I did this. I mean, that would be excessive. I mean, generally there are things you can't do anything about anyway, so it just makes you feel depressed. Well, there was a British statesman, I think between the wars, who kind of boasted that he had no imagination for evil. And I don't know what the context was, but the sense of it was that he was above that. He could not imagine these terrible things that somebody else had done, just beyond him. And Jung heard about it and wrote this, and I've even lost where it appears, so I can't give you the source. But Jung says, man has done these things, all these horrors, all these atrocities. Man has done these things. I am a man who has his share of human nature. Therefore, I am guilty with the rest and bear unaltered and indelibly within me the capacity and the inclination to do them again at any time. Then he goes on, none of us stands outside humanity's black collective shadow. Whether the crime occurred many generations back or happens today, it remains the symptom of a disposition that is always and everywhere present. And one would therefore do well to possess some imagination for evil. That was the statesman's phrase. For only the fool can permanently disregard the conditions of his own nature. In fact, this negligence is the best means of making him an instrument of evil. That is, if you have the idea that you're so saintly, that you're above it, and you could not possibly have anything to do with that wicked stuff, that is the best means of making yourself an instrument of evil. Because you're choosing to be unconscious of your own reality. I think that's probably psychologically what the notion of original sin has to do with, that we all share in being human, and therefore, what was that Latin thing? Nothing human is foreign to me. I can't remember the Latin. I think we're in a healthier condition if we understand that any horror we read about, we perhaps also could commit, than if we think we couldn't possibly. That's a better place to be. It gives you more freedom of action. Any response to that? If it was inconceivable, that was their poverty in a way. So we're better off if we recognize that we all feel murderous toward our kids sometimes at some level. Yeah.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.